Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Many of the headlines today focused on the visit from the Prime Minister of Japan, Kishida. Much of the focus has actually been on the state dinner that will take place tonight at the White House. And the First Lady, Jill Biden, actually rolled out some of the menu and some of the decorations that the guests will be dining around this evening. And interesting, they'll actually have silk butterflies that will be above the tables, these silk butterflies. And the First Lady actually may have given an important statement for the beginning before any of the talk started. She said, as our nations navigate the winds of change, we do so together as partners in peace and prosperity. So underneath the butterfly questions, let's get down to what the dialogue looked like today with the president and the prime minister. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, when the president and the prime minister took their seats today, I think it's an important thing. And I actually want to go back to this whole idea that Jill Biden, the First Lady, put forward in terms of these beautiful silk butterflies that will be part of the decor at the state dinner tonight. The Bidens have gotten very good at this state dinner thing in terms of really featuring things from both countries. And butterflies are an interesting component, and it leads to important questions. And really interesting, years ago, Emperor Hirohito, the grandfather of His Majesty and well-known biologist, asked the ultimate in questions. Questions are actually important things from great leaders. He said, "Why have I not seen butterflies in my garden recently?" And that simple question actually galvanized all of Japan to address some serious environmental pollution. And it was a really powerful example of what happens when you have focused questions followed by action. And so I love to get to these butterfly questions, these simple things. So him asking, why haven't I seen any butterflies in my garden, was really a prerequisite to the pollution is making it so the butterflies can't come to the garden. And the two leaders of these two nations have a lot of questions, some of them very significant and obvious, and some of them much under the surface that they have to get to. And so I want to go through some of these questions and some of the answers that came out of the conversations today. All of these, of course, leading up to a very interesting moment tomorrow, where you will actually have the leaders of the U.S., Japan, and the Philippines in a trilateral meeting for the first time, which will also be very instructive and very important for that region. So let's start with President Biden. The president began the press conference by remarking on the progress made to bolster that Pacific alliance, not just with Japan, but with others during the course of his administration.
Our alliances are America's greatest asset. The relationship with Japan is powerful proof of that, that investing in our alliance and raising our collective ambitions, we yield remarkable results. Over the last 3 years, the partnership between Japan and the United States has been transformed into a truly global partnership. And that's thanks in no small part to the courageous leadership of Prime Minister Kishida. And I mean that sincerely.
There was lots of praise for Prime Minister Kishida throughout the remarks from President Biden in terms of everything from what's happening globally, not just economics. I think that we often get swallowed up in that when we talk about our relationship with Japan. But there's so many other things. The president also, in addition to the economic ties, talked about some of the other common goals to increase prosperity in the two countries.
On the economic front, our ties have never been more robust. Japan is the top foreign investor in the United States, and we, the United States, are the top foreign investor in Japan. Nearly 1 million Americans work in Japanese companies here in the United States.
That was one of those think again moments, I think, in the course of that context that under the surface, I don't think many people realize that we are one another's greatest foreign investors, U.S. being the number one foreign investor into Japan, Japan being number one foreign investor into the U.S. Over 1 million jobs are held by American citizens through Japanese companies. So there are real clear ties and important ties there. And then, of course, when you start looking at the geopolitical dynamics of all of this, Prime Minister Kishida, in his remarks, spoke about a new direction of Japan, strengthening their defense capabilities, increasing their defense budget, which has been a very slow thing for Japan since World War II, a big turnaround from previous Japanese policy. And obviously, a lot of that has been dictated by the aggression of China and North Korea, other actors in the region. So here's Prime Minister Kishida. This is coming through a translator during the press conference.
Japan is determined to strengthen our defense force through position of counter-strike capabilities, increase our defense budget, and was reassured by President Biden of his strong support for such efforts. We confirmed again the urgency to further bolster the deterrence and response capabilities of our alliance.
So clearly Japan has gotten itself on a different footing as it relates to defense. I think with what China has done in the region, what North Korea continues to do in the region, that they feel like they have to do some things to bolster their ability to defend themselves. And, of course, they look to the U.S. as a crucial partner in all of that. And we'll be getting later on in the week as we talk about these tri-country talks that will take place tomorrow with the Philippines, U.S., and Japan, also looking to bolster security in the region. Prime Minister Kishida also mentioned China directly, saying that they'll work together to deal with the challenges regarding China and the Taiwan Strait, important shipping lane there, and work with the country to make progress towards common goals.
We agreed that our two countries will continue to respond to challenges concerning China through close coordination. At the same time, we confirmed the importance of continuing our dialogue with China and cooperating with China on common challenges. We also underscored the importance of peace and stability in the Taiwan Straits and confirmed opposition to encourage peaceful resolution of the issue.
So I think those are crucial parts of that conversation. One of the interesting moments for me in the press conference with the Prime Minister and President Biden was talking about North Korea. Prime Minister Kishida has been outspoken in saying that he would engage in talks with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, and many have criticized him inside of Japan and in the region for engaging. And it was interesting that President Biden responded and said, no, we should be willing to have conversations, not without conditions, not without getting a few things straight. But that idea of having dialogue was a crucial thing that both of the leaders said we need to have happen. President Biden mentioned his conversations with the Prime Minister of China, President Xi, and that we have to have dialogue, that having dialogue is better than not having dialogue. And so I thought that was an interesting component to all of this. President Biden also answered a reporter's question about the most recent conversation he had with the Israeli Prime Minister, really taking this to a global scale, talking about the ongoing efforts to free hostages held by Hamas and bring more aid to the people of Gaza.
Bibi and I had a long discussion. He agreed to do several things that related to, number one, getting more aid, both food and medicine, into Gaza, and reducing significantly the attempts, the civilian casualties in any action taken in the region. And it's tied to the hostages. We'll get these hostages home where they belong, but also bring back a six-week ceasefire that we need now. So we'll see what he does in terms of meeting the commitments he made to me.
So all of that from the press conference today in the Rose Garden, a great setting for the leaders of the two nations of Japan and the United States, Prime Minister Kishida and President Biden, going through a wide range of topics and a lot of underlying questions. Again, we talk about those butterfly questions that have a ripple effect. And many of them seem small and insignificant. Some of them seem purely economic. But by the time the press conference was over, you could see how interconnected all of this was and how it connected to China, to North Korea, to Russia and Ukraine, to Israel and Hamas and Gaza. They're all interconnected. It is a complex world. And those little underlying questions are often the things that we need to think again about. And today, the president and the prime minister began that as it relates to the U.S.-Japan alliance. We'll be right back.
Boy. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
We're going to take a look now at the very complicated dynamics between the U.S., the U.N., Israel, everything that's happening there in the Middle East. And things got even more complicated over the last 24 hours as the United States and the Biden administration has continued to push Israel and Hamas to agree to a 6 to 8 week ceasefire that would allow, obviously, more aid to go in to the innocent Palestinian civilians there inside of Gaza. And the big component to make all of that ceasefire work, of course, is the release of hostages. And over the last 24 hours, Hamas has been negotiating again with Israel and others in the region. The talks have been ongoing in Cairo, Egypt, with Qatar really serving as the main mediator with Hamas's leadership, who are mostly hunkered down in the Gaza Strip somewhere. And so as you look at that deal that everyone seems to be in favor of, from the UN to the U.S., other allies around the world, everyone, I think, wants to get to that ceasefire. But, of course, a critical component to that is those that have been taken hostage and been held for over 187 days. There's nothing about that works. Hostages are hostages. They shouldn't be there. But over the last 24 hours, Hamas has told negotiators that it can't do the deal because it doesn't have 40 Israeli hostages that it can release as part of a temporary ceasefire deal with Israel. So that admission raises all kinds of questions about the remaining hostages. At this point, the number is 133 hostages out of the 240 that were abducted on October 7th, and the addition of about 1,200 that were killed on the Israeli side of the border, 133 hostages are unaccounted for. And so if Hamas is saying we only have 40, and then this is also a group, they said there are some that are Israeli soldiers, both male and female Israeli soldiers, that they're unwilling to give up at this point. But the question then is, what else has gone on? Who is still alive? Who has the others? And so there's a whole host of questions. So I think the talks just got immensely more complicated because that will be a line, I think, for the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to say, wait a minute, if the hostages are not alive, we should know that. If they're being held by someone else other than Hamas, that needs to be known. Or if you're just unwilling to say who you have and who you don't have, it's tough to negotiate. And while everyone agrees that getting more aid in is important and steps have been taken since last weekend, since President Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu had their last direct conversation, there has been additional aid going in, not enough by anybody's standard, I don't believe. But it does get it more complicated and more uncertain and less clear in terms of what the path forward is. And part of this is a lot of confusion, even inside of Israel, because of the mixed messages coming out of the United States. Just last week, as we covered here on the show, you had on one day, you had very stern, very blistering remarks from President Biden towards Benjamin Netanyahu in terms of what needed to be done following the killing of innocent aid workers who were delivering food and supplies to citizens there inside of Gaza. And the same day, the announcement of the additional sale of F-16 fighter jets, weaponry, and arms as part of that deal. That sends a whole host of mixed messages. Meanwhile, inside of Israel, it's also very complicated and complex. Benjamin Netanyahu is clearly not popular at the moment inside of Israel, even amongst his own people. And a lot of his own allies are starting to splinter as they see that it's going to be very difficult for the prime minister to hold on to power inside of Israel for very long. And many have accused Benjamin Netanyahu of simply dragging things out because it preserves his power. His chief rival, Benny Gantz, who's also part of the war cabinet, is now calling for early elections this September. And according to everyone we've talked to, Gantz would easily lead Netanyahu and take over the prime ministership. So that's an interesting dynamic, even inside of what's going on in Israel. We've been critical of Benjamin Netanyahu over the course of the last summer with a lot of the things that he was doing to centralize power, strip some of the power away from their Supreme Court, move it into the executive branch. And so there's a lot of challenges and things going on for Benjamin Netanyahu inside of Israel. So that creates additional uncertainty. And so then the question becomes, so what is the United States' role? And part of these mixed messages that the Biden administration has been sending have also come under some speculation and some criticism from people inside the administration and outside the administration, people that are traditionally President Biden's allies and those that he's usually at odds with, that there doesn't seem to be a clear, cohesive strategy or message as it relates to Israel and the relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu. And obviously, Israel has been a staunch ally and partner of the United States in the region for a long time. Those things, I suspect, will continue, but things are getting more complicated. And then, of course, you have things going on at the United Nations. The United Nations, of course, passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. And the only reason that passed was because the United States abstained from voting. Because remember, as a permanent member of the Security Council, the United States has veto power. There's been a number of resolutions about ceasefire, including those put forward by the United States that were vetoed or voted against by China and by Russia. And so a lot of this has kind of gone around and around. And so then the question becomes, now that the United Nations has passed a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire, what is the United States' role? And all of this goes to a lot of the confusion and a lot of the uncertainty, I think, in terms of the UN of late. The UN resolutions that are written without enforcement measures can't force Israel to stop what its leaderships insist is a justified war necessary to remove Hamas and prevent another October 7th massacre. But it's also critical that what the entity can make Israel stop. And it isn't. And that's what the United States is and isn't doing as it relates to that UN resolution. And so all of this leads us back to the question of where do we go from here? Because to me, that's the real question in terms of leadership. Because if we can't get to a clarity in terms of direction, and this is where it's leadership and influence for the United States, clearly the United States cannot dictate to Israel what it can and cannot do for what it feels is its own security and protection. And clearly, Hamas complicates that by continuing to put out statements that there will be more October the 7th style attacks. That gives Israel more reason to say we have to defend and we have to stamp out Hamas. They're clearly out to the end to make sure that they wipe Israel off the map. Meanwhile, you've got the hostage situation. Now we're not even certain how many hostages are alive or how many of them are in the control of Hamas and how many may be held by other groups inside of Gaza. So it's all getting more complicated, not less. It's a little more muddy than it is clear. But the thing that is clear in my mind is that we have to get to a different kind of conversation in terms of what the go-forward strategy is. How do you balance those things in terms of protection and national security? How do you make sure that innocent civilians are not being targeted and that they are getting the aid and the help that they need? And that's going to require leadership that we haven't seen on the world stage from any country, including the United States, in quite a while. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. We'll come back. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, as we've been reporting, the Biden administration has had an idea as part of their education policy, and that is to make the process to apply for financial aid easier. The program is known as FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A, helps millions of students to get help from the federal government to attend college. The challenge, however, has been that the implementation of their plan wasn't quite as easy as they thought. We've heard this before. It is always takes longer, and there's always more glitches than you think. But now the glitches in the system have delayed thousands and thousands of students from even applying for, let alone receiving, aid. It's created a lot of uncertainty, a lot of frustration by university and college administrators, as well as students and families who are trying to figure out where they should send their students to college based on what kind of aid they might be able to receive. Not long ago, I spoke with a reporter at Reason.com, Emma Camp, who's been following this story very closely, and she gave a great breakdown of what went wrong and, more importantly, the impact it's having on students and parents. Here's part of that conversation.
Okay, so to start off with what's happening with the FAFSA, the Education Department has really bungled it this year. So in 2020, Congress passed a law that required the FAFSA to be streamlined, to make it a simpler form to fill out. That sounds like a great idea, right? Well, the Education Department seems to have had a hard time doing this. So they had a really long delay in getting the FAFSA form out. Normally, it comes out in October. This year, it didn't come out until New Year's Eve, and they didn't extend that deadline for families. And almost immediately, when students and families started filling it out, they started facing these really infuriating technical glitches. You know, people were having a hard time logging in. They were getting locked out. The form was having all of these kind of nonsensical technical bugs. And a lot of them were affecting people really long term. So just until, you know, a couple weeks ago, if you have a parent without a social security number, which is mostly students who have an undocumented parent, you couldn't fill out the form at all. And just recently, the Education Department announced that they miscalculated the estimated family contributions for 200,000 students who had reported their own financial assets, things like cash savings or investments. And this is really putting people's college decisions at risk, right? The FAFSA form is required if you want to get federal grants and loans, and it's required by the vast majority of colleges if you want to get financial aid.
Yeah, and so let's dig into some of those components. So one, not surprising, things don't tend to run on time when they're making those kinds of changes in government programs or systems or processes. But it's stunning to me that they didn't get this done, not in the fall, but it went all the way to New Year's Eve, but there was no change in the deadline. That had to be infuriating for a lot of folks.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there's going to be many families who aren't able to get the form in on time, especially families that have other issues that have kept them from being able to fill out the form until recently.
Yeah, and let's talk about some of those downstream impacts as it relates. You mentioned it briefly, but I want you to unpack that for us a little bit in terms of the requirements for those who want to get some of that federal aid or federal grants, having to really suspend or put off making some of those crucial decisions.
Yeah, this is really going to throw a lot of people's plans up in the air. This form is absolutely required, like you said, if you want to get federal grants and loans. And also for, you know, a lot of people, most people apply to multiple colleges, you get different financial aid offers. And most of those colleges rely on the FAFSA when deciding how much financial aid to offer to students. And, you know, college decision day is May 1st, if I remember correctly. And, you know, parents and students want that information before May 1st so they can decide, you know, are they going to choose the cheaper school? And, you know, the way this is going, by the time people have to decide where to start their education, they're not going to have all of the really important financial information that they need.
Yeah, and obviously that's going to impact a lot of things, including how some of those schools function rolling into the fall. If there's not a certainty in terms of who's actually coming and showing up, what those needs are. I want to actually get to the parent portion that you just alluded to. The students not being able to decide on May 1st is one big deal, but parents not really knowing, hey, are we going to have to pick up another job or are we going to have to sell some assets or change some behavior in order to make ends meet are just not going to be able to make those kinds of decisions.
Right. This is so infuriating for university administrators who just don't have the manpower to individually calculate how much financial aid they're going to give to every student. It's infuriating to parents. And some schools, you know, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal about this. They're already reporting that they're getting fewer FAFSA forms from students.
So that was my conversation with Emma Camp from Reason talking about this poor rollout. Again, it's called FAFSAs, the Federal Student Aid, and getting that in. And with these changes that the government made, the Department of Education has made it absolutely impossible for students, for families, and for colleges to work through the whole process. So this is one of those things where it goes to the agency. Again, Congress made a rule, a law, and then the agency is supposed to carry it out. The agency drops the ball, and so now it's coming back to Congress. In fact, it came back to Congress in a big way today. And Utah Congressman Burgess Owens, who was acting as the chair of the Higher Education and Workforce Development Subcommittee, was leading the hearing today. And he weighed in on some of the failures in this rollout. And here's how he began the hearing today. Here's Utah Congressman Burgess Owens.
With the financial burden of colleges growing each year, it was incredibly important that reform ease the FAFSA process for families. The new law streamlined the long, complex application process. Today, the committee is poised for a familiar challenge, oversight. Despite our efforts, the Department of Education's FAFSA rollout was mired in delays and dysfunction. Without accountability, the Department of Education botched implementation threatens to damage students, families, and institutions.
Representative Owens went on to talk about the effect this problem is going to have on the education system and downstream.
These failures are not just impact the taxpayer, who always pay the cost of bureaucratic dysfunction. Institutions could be seen as an estimated 20% drop in enrollment this year. Low-income students who require access to aid are going to be the hardest hit. And these delays don't even account for next year's FAFSA, which will almost certainly be not be ready by October. Within 3 years, the Biden administration, Department of Education, has managed to bring the educational industry to a possible game-changing crisis.
It is a crisis of credibility across the board. It was interesting. Rachel Feldman, who's the vice provost at the for enrollment at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, told the committee and Representative Owens that the school typically has all of the financial aid offers out to accepted applicants by the end of March. And now here we are on April the 10th, and they have not sent out a single one. Not a single aid offer has been extended to a single student who has applied for aid and admissions at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And so you can see this uncertainty in how this all unravels. And this is one more area where if we want to have trust in the institutions have to do what they say they're going to do when they say they're going to do it. Because the more we undermine that confidence and that credibility, the more problems we have in terms of just our civilians and our citizens really having confidence that government can get anything done. This was a form, a process, but it's impacting thousands of students and families and universities and colleges across the country. One more problem we got to get straightened out. All right, we'll step aside for some top of the hour news. Come back with a big hour number two, including a conversation with J.D. Tichilli of, does America want a dictator or are we just making one? We'll get into that coming up next. Stick around.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, in America, we always say we don't want a king, we don't want a dictator. Those are always the headlines. We're free. We fought a war over that against England 250 years ago. But the question beyond the headline and the thing we need to think again about is, while we say we don't want a dictator, are we actually creating one? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Yes, democracy is messy. It feels slow and cumbersome, and often it fails to live up to the principles we profess to believe. In American democracy today, far too much time is being spent on pounding on opponents or political parties, and it is actually doing the work of the people. And so how do we change that? And how do we do that without actually giving ourselves a king? If you don't read anything else today, this is the read of reads today. It's by our good friend J.D. Tuccilli. He is the contributing editor at Reason, and the piece is actually titled Americans Don't Want a Dictatorship, But They're Creating One Anyway. J.D., welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Always great to have you, and I knew this was going to be where we wanted to start hour number two the moment I saw your headline today, and then the more I read, the more I thought, oh, this is so on the money. And so let's start with the premise of this. We always say we're a free country. We don't want no stinking king. We don't want a dictator here. It seems like we are actually creating one. Describe that for us.
Yeah, we're kind of inching in that direction, and it's actually more than inching. It's kind of creeping pretty fast.
Yeah.
And a big part of the problem is Americans are kind of ambivalent about the idea of restrained government and a restrained presidency. I was riffing off of a recent poll by AP NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research, out of the University of Chicago, and they headlined it about, you know, half of Americans think it would be bad if the next president is able to act on important policy issues without the approval of Congress or the courts. And only about 21% think it would be a good thing. And I mean, it is good that more Americans think that would be bad than think it would be good. But this is a 250-year-old republic, and really, we can only get 48% of respondents to say that turning the presidency into an absolute monarchy would be bad. I mean, I just find that a little surprising.
Yeah,
but the thing is, go ahead.
I'll keep going.
Well, I was going to say, it's actually supported by other polling. There was a poll by University of Virginia Center for Politics in 2021, which found that a similar 20% of both Trump and Biden voters strongly agree it would be better if a president could take needed actions without being constrained by Congress or courts. And the previous year, the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group found that over three annual surveys, about 24% of Americans say that a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with Congress elections is a good way to govern a country. Now, that's only a fifth to a quarter of the population, but really, consistently, only about half think a dictatorship is a bad thing.
Wow. And that's what worries me, because it's sort of become in our politics. I used to always describe it as the Dennis Rodman syndrome. Like, everybody hated Dennis Rodman when he was a basketball player. He was dirty. He was cheap. He was wild. He was out of control. And nobody hated him more than the Chicago Bulls, right up to the point he became their Dennis Rodman. And even though he was still awful, horrible, terrible on all of those fronts, he got him, 21 rebounds, several steals, and wreaked havoc on the other team's best player. And so now it's sort of become the same thing in our politics of, well, if my team's got the power, if my team has the White House, then yes, I definitely want a presidency who can not have to wait on Congress to actually get things done.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, and the pollsters ask people, okay, if you're a Democrat and Biden wins in November, what do you say now about an unrestrained presidency? And the numbers in favor of it doubled. They asked Republicans the same thing, and the numbers almost tripled. And the fact is, people are much less opposed to the idea of a dictatorship if they think it's their dictator. And when they ask more deeply, okay, which branch of government do you think has too much power? It's always a branch of government that's in somebody else's hands. Mm. Republicans think the presidency and the executive branch is too powerful. Democrats think the Supreme Court is too powerful. Of course, the Supreme Court leans conservative, and the presidency is held by Democrat Joe Biden right now. The fact is, Americans really don't like restrained government if they're the ones exercising power. They only want a restrained if it's the other guy in power.
Yeah, as long as it's my dictator, then it's okay, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the fact is, they're getting what they want. We had run another piece, and I quoted from it. It's by Gene Healy, who wrote a book, The Cult of the Presidency. It came out about 15 years ago, although it's just been revised recently because frankly, the presidency is getting more culty. And he pointed out that over decades, the presidency has been accumulating more and more unilateral power as people ask the government to do more and more. And the president is the face of the government, the most obvious, you know, singular face. And people keep on handing off more authority to the executive branch because they want the president to fix everything, to the point now where presidents can do stuff like try to absolve people of owing the student loans, try to pass executive orders that kind of legislates unilaterally. We're not at an elective monarchy yet, but we're getting very close to that point. And the fact is that there's a significant constituency out there for an elective monarchy, so long as they think it's somebody on their side who's exercising that power.
Yeah. And so as we look at that, and I think there's another element to this that's really fascinating to me, and that is, so we have citizens who are looking to Washington more and more to solve any big problem, whether it's a student loan problem, whatever it may be, look to the president, look to the executive branch to just do it with the stroke of a pen. We also have Congress that continues to abdicate authority to the executive branch so that they don't have to be held accountable for things. And that also helps to consolidate that power in an elected monarchy.
Oh, absolutely so. I mean, we've seen that in terms of war powers where Congress doesn't want to be. You have to go through the messy, act of engaging in violence. They delegate it to the executive branch. A lot of laws these days are kind of written with broad frameworks with the details be filled in by the executive branch. And then Congress just does nothing a lot of the time. Yeah. Now, the fact is Congress not passing a law doesn't mean it's a do-nothing Congress. If Congress votes down a law, maybe that's the something that they're supposed to be doing. But if they're just stuck and if they don't want responsibility, if they just want to pose before cameras and then pass responsibility off to the executive branch, we are going to end up with an empowered executive branch and a legislature that kind of becomes vestigial.
Yeah, it's such a powerful thing in all of that. And then, of course, the problem with all of that in the current model, without a real monarchy, is when the executive branch does things by the executive order, then somebody files a lawsuit that works its way up to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court becomes incredibly political, and we wonder why.
Well, exactly so. I mean, if you have a presidency that becomes kind of the fulfillment of people's hopes, wishes, and fears, and the only check on it, to one extent or another, is going to be the Supreme Court, they're going to be seen at odds with each other. And those who favor whatever whoever is in the White House at the time is doing are going to resent the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court is going to be the rally point for those who oppose that president of the White House. So, and that's exactly what we're seeing, of course, in the numbers with Republicans kind of supporting the Supreme Court against the presidency, and Democrats supporting the president against the Supreme Court. I mean, that's exactly the dynamic that's taken place in recent years.
Yeah, this is a great piece. J.D. Cicilli, one of the best of the best, contributing editor at Reason. It is your must-read assignment for the day. Americans don't want a dictatorship, but they're creating one anyway. J.D., as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Great perspective there from J.D. And we'll come back with some more inside sources as we look at this whole idea of the fact that we say we don't want a dictatorship. We say we don't want a king or a monarchy or a queen. But a lot of our actions are leading us that way. And as J.D. points out in the piece, that it is really not just inching. It's starting to creep and creep a little faster. And so that requires all of us to take a look at where is that balance of power, and do we like that unlimited power or unrestrained power when it's in our favor, when our person is in the White House or when our team is in control of Congress or the court? That's not how it's supposed to work. And so the important thing for all of us is to make sure we're looking at that, not just who has the power and is my team winning. We have to look at it as what's best for the country and what's best for the future. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We'd all like to see a little less dysfunction and a little more function in Congress these days. And one of the obstacles to move legislation forward at a proper pace is the current rule regarding the motion to vacate the chair. in the House. Today it's far too easy for disgruntled lawmakers to threaten to replace the Speaker of the House, throw the process into chaos. We saw this play out last year, of course, with the ouster of then-Speaker Kevin McCarthy. However, previously, under Nancy Pelosi, it was pretty hard to vacate the speakership. It actually required real consensus in order to get to that, if that was going to be the case. So we want to take a look at where it is and what actually could be done to make this a little better process while still preserving the things that are there within the Constitution. And there's a way to get about that. It's having the right conversation as opposed to a lot of this performative politics stuff that we have seen. Someone who's taken a look at how we really take the positive steps toward transforming Congress in this space, Robert Oldham is a social impact fellow at New American, a PhD candidate at Princeton University. And Robert, welcome to the show.
Hi, Boyd. Thanks for having me on.
Great piece in Politico with a couple of your colleagues there. Give us a little sense. Obviously, we've seen the drama playing out in Washington this week with another threat from Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene in terms of this vacating of the chair. But break it down for us in terms of kind of the better way. If we want to have this, why do we have this rule to begin with? And then how do we make it actually be a little bit more productive?
Yeah, so the motion to vacate currently, where you just have to have one member bring forward a motion that can pass on a majority of the House, this was put in place at the beginning of the 118th Congress when they were forming the, negotiating over to get McCarthy into the speaker position and to try to get ready for the session to start. The conservatives that were not voting for McCarthy, this was one of the demands that they wanted, was they wanted a motion to vacate where one member could basically say, if we want to have a vote on getting rid of the speaker, we can have the speaker. McCarthy tried to negotiate that down, he wanted it to be at least five members. He wanted, he tried various things to make it so he wouldn't kind of face this gun to the head, but it didn't really work. They demanded the one member motion to vacate, and so that's what he got.
Yeah, and
Go ahead.
I want to get into your proposal, and obviously under Speaker Pelosi, that was not the rule. But give us kind of the origin story of the rule, why it's in there, and then why it has changed.
It's essentially a motion of no confidence. You see these in most legislative settings where you can vote to get rid of the speaker. We've seen this used back far back in House history. It was threatened at least against Speaker Joseph Cannon back in the early 20th century. So, it's just kind of it's a feature of legislative politics. I would say that there's a mechanism available to the legislative body in order to get rid of the current leadership if they don't like it.
Yeah, and of course that should be a proper thing within a legislative body. And I think again historically it's required a little more than one. Usually it's been at least half or some large number, so it would have to do that. You and your colleagues have a really interesting proposal that I think is worth thinking about. That doesn't get rid of the idea of vacating the chair, but it causes it to be something very different. Explain it to us.
Yeah, so we're basically proposing, instead of a vote of no confidence, which is what the current motion to vacate allows, it is a motion of a constructive no confidence. So you see this in other democracies. Germany and Spain, for example, both have this, where basically the rule says that if you are going to propose to get rid of the current government or, in our case, House leadership structure, if you want a new speaker, then on the motion where you said we're going to get rid of the speaker, so we're going to get rid of Mike Johnson, you have to specify who's going to replace Johnson as a result. So this is basically, what happened back in last fall when they got rid of McCarthy. They replaced something, the McCarthy leadership structure, with nothing. So, you can think of this as a decapitation of the House with, let's be honest, there was really no plan to replace what was going to come after McCarthy. So this kind of gets away of the idea that you can just go in and blow things up and then, walk away, let the bridge burn behind you type thing. You actually have to have a plan in place and, someone who can take over a speaker that the people that are vacating or, voting to get rid of the speaker, that they agree on. So, obviously this would probably be difficult for, very conservative Republicans and then, Democrats, you need a considerable number of Democratic votes to get rid of a Republican speaker. It would probably be very difficult for them to come together on a consensus candidate. So this would take a lot of the chaos-inducing nature that we saw in that previous motion to vacate. That would be gone.
Yeah, and I think there's something to that. One, removing the chaos, this whole idea of replacing something with nothing. But it would force those who want to vacate the speaker or replace the speaker to say, hey, we think so-and-so, we think candidate A should be the speaker, or representative B should be the speaker, because that shows the cards and some thought much more than just, hey, we don't like this person because they didn't give us what we wanted, so we're going to ouster them. It requires much more, and I think that would completely change the conversation in terms of what that might look like actually on the floor of the House.
Yeah, it would certainly allow some of these speakers the ability to probably sleep a little bit, a little bit easier at night, knowing that obviously in politics there's lots of many different factions and many different people that are gunning for you at any moment. But it's often easier for them to come together and be opposed to something rather than come together and actually offer a new plan. So if you're Mike Johnson or whatever speaker comes next in our history, knowing that your opponents actually have to agree on something other than the fact that they just don't like you, that's probably going to make your life a little bit easier.
Yeah, I don't know if it makes the speaker sleep any better at night, but they would at least be able to govern better during the day. And I think that's actually the real purpose there, to get people to a point where they can function from a position of strength and confidence, as opposed to functioning from a position of weakness, where every move and every conversation, someone's going to be offended or counter-offended or preemptively offended and threaten your speakership. I just don't think that's any way to govern a country or a Congress. So as you look at this moving forward, as you've shared this idea, any traction there, any allies or common cause folks that might say, hey, this is something that we ought to be talking about? I doubt anything's going to happen before the next election, but maybe in the new Congress at the January of 2025.
I would also be surprised if anything changed before the end of this Congress, but hope springs eternal, I guess. I think there's people who have kind of proposed ideas similar to this one, at least at the very least different from the one person motion to vacate. Like you mentioned, the fact that under Pelosi you had to have a majority of at least one party had to sign on to the motion to vacate. So that in itself would be a positive change. Representative Tim Burchett, who was actually one of the members of the original rebels that ousted McCarthy, he's also suggested something similar, where you would have to have unanimous agreement among Republicans on who the next speaker would be if you're going to get rid of the current speaker. So, we've seen some of these ideas percolating up. I don't think Americans are often looking to other countries to kind of see how we should do things. We have obviously a unique political system, so there's some reasons for that. We've seen that, this work in other countries, and I think there's reason to think that this could be a something for reformers and for members of Congress to think about going
forward. Definitely. This is definitely something worth thinking about for sure. Robert Oldham, Social Impact Fellow at New America, PhD candidate at Princeton University. Great piece in Politico today. Check that out. And Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on, Boyd. Take care.
All right, it's Robert Oldham, Social Impact Fellow at New America, and it is a great piece. I hadn't thought of it in these terms, but I do think it's worth thinking again about in terms of this simple rule, and it sort of played out with Kevin McCarthy, who was so determined to become the speaker that he was willing to negotiate down to allowing a single member to issue a motion to vacate the chair, and then, as Robert pointed out, then you replace something with nothing. And that's easy. Anybody can do that. It's Robert pointed out, it's like you're burning the bridge and away you go. And I always say, may the bridges you burn light your way. And I think that's what we've been seeing in the chaos of Congress. And so to require those with that motion to vacate also saying who they would appoint or who they would nominate as the successor, I think completely changes the conversation. That's worth thinking about. We'll be right back.
Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program, we actually started today, of course, with the big summit taking place with President Biden and Prime Minister Kishida of Japan. And they will have a big state dinner tonight. And then, of course, tomorrow they will have a trilateral summit with Prime Minister Marcos from the Philippines as well. Again, all important in that region of the world. But really interesting, just listening to Prime Minister Kishida today always brings back a lot of connections to Japan for me. And the thing that I kept going back to as I was listening to a lot of the subtleties and a lot of the details that Prime Minister Kishida was sharing in his comments today was this whole thing of small and the little incremental pieces that actually make the biggest difference. We live in this society where bigger is always better. Every day the world turns on really small and seemingly insignificant acts by very ordinary people. But yet we're always focused on how do we make it bigger? How do we make it better? How do we make it broader? And I think there's actually a significance to the insignificant. Understanding the power of what the world would deem as insignificant actions, while also really understanding the insignificance of our own place in the world. I think we all felt that a little bit with all the coverage of the eclipse on Monday. And so when we look at this, I always go back to when I was in Japan back in 1985. And I remember meeting a man there by the name of Yamaguchi. He was 94 years old. We had a lovely chat and discussion on a wide range of things. He was absolutely brilliant. We actually solved all the world's problems in a single afternoon. It was an epic day for me. But as we were getting ready to leave his home, he stopped me and he said, you know, Boyd, all these things we've talked about, all these principles are good and right. They'll help people be successful and happy. He said, but there's one more principle that you have to understand. And he actually made me a promise. He said, I want you to promise me that you'll remember this principle and never forget it. And I said, okay, I promise, I'll remember. And this is what he said. He said, Zo to you know wa kamude wa nai kedo, mushi to you know wa kamude aro. And with that, he closed the door behind us, and I was walking down the street trying to figure out what he really meant, translating it back and forth between English and Japanese. And it was a really simple saying. Elephants don't bite, but fleas do. Elephants don't bite, but fleas do. And I go back to that principle all the time. The big things in life tend to take care of themselves. But often it's what we do with the little things that either holds us back or really propels us forward to the accomplishment of a goal or an objective. Look at the Olympic Games. Olympic Games, it always comes down to a fraction of a point, hundredth of a second, width of a bike tire, length of a skate that usually makes the difference between being the gold medal champion and someone who just participated. It's that close. It's those little things. And so as we look at the big issues of our day, I think a lot of those can be solved by a lot of very small issues that each of us can do every day. Because we have to remember that it is community and culture that lead. The politics and the policy will follow if we do what we need to do in our homes, in our neighborhoods, and in our communities. Because it is those small things. And to me, it's the small and insignificant, seemingly insignificant, that are the things that are actually most important. And it actually got me thinking back a couple of years ago. It was the funeral of former President George H.W. Bush. And during his funeral service, which was just an extraordinary thing there at the National Cathedral, there was a story told of a very small, a very humble act of service performed by one of President Bush's friends and former Secretary of State, James Baker. They talked about how Secretary Baker was at the foot of the president's bed often as the president spent his last days and hours, and that James Baker rubbed and stroked the president's feet for almost an hour. And I remember watching that funeral. And as this story was told, the cameras panned over to where James Baker was sitting. And he just very quietly just had his head bowed and was just sobbing. And he said as he watched this play out, the president smiled at James Baker. And I had this vision of here you had a world leader, James Baker, who was serving someone who had been the world's leader of the free world, the former president. And I thought that was just such an interesting moment, and just how something as simple as that could make such a big difference. And I think we all have to maybe think again about what we think we know about what we do every day, because it may be as insignificant as going to pick up somebody's child from school when they're sick, or shoveling dirt for a neighbor who's got a big pile to move. But it's all those little things that make the big things pretty insignificant. We can get wrapped up in the news of the day. We can have heartburn over the headaches in Washington, D.C. We can get stressed out about social media. But what have we done that just makes a difference today? Because in the end, those seemingly insignificant things are the most significant things. They're the things that will change your day. They're the things that will change your world. They're the things that will make a difference for somebody else as well. And that's what's most significant. Well, that wraps it up for us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. Thanks for joining us. I am Boyd Matheson. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios,
this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.